Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, along with a broad range of frequencies designed to impart calm and concentration, or energy and inspiration, depending on how loud you listen. Later on, we'll meet the would-be mogul who's opening up the functional sound market with his artisanal white noise app, Fuzzle. And we talked to the musicologist Jeremy Dibble about the down-born composer and conductor Hamilton Harty. But we begin with Brian Jackson, the pianist and composer whose long-term collaboration with Gil Scott-Heron left behind some of the 1970s most politically potent and enduring records. Gil Scott-Heron died in 2011, but Jackson is still recording and performing and coming to this year's Cork Jazz Festival. The first album the pair recorded together was 1971. One's Pieces of a Man, a title that Jackson, as socially concerned as ever, also used as the title of a podcast he made, highlighting the plight of death row inmate Keith Lamar, as Brian Jackson told Culture File.
My wife had come across an article about how to survive solitary time during the pandemic, and it was written by a man named Keith Lamar. Jagged jigsaw pieces. Turns out that Keith was incarcerated. He was in prison for, he'd been in prison for, at the time, almost 30 years for a crime that, once we read his book, we realized that he couldn't have possibly committed. And we got kind of involved in trying to figure out what we could do. What we could do to help. And we got in touch with him. I got in touch with him and we started having meetings and we became friends. He's such a great speaker and such an articulate person that I thought this would be, it coincided with my intention to start a podcast because I like to talk.
Each week, we look at the lies we're uncovering and the truths we are constantly discovering that help us to extract the splinters of society from our minds. This podcast is about music, justice, and everything in between.
But at the same time, it made people aware of this great injustice that, you know, that it had taken place on Keith's behalf. And just, you know, just briefly, there was a riot and some inmates were killed. There were a few people who were identified as being responsible for those murders. One of the people that they identified was Keith. All of them copped a plea, you know, in other words, they said they were guilty in exchange for decreased time. But Keith, being young, believed in the justice system and believed that if I'm not guilty, you know, why should I make a plea deal? Well, this is kind of the wrong, you know, approach, even though it's right, because they punished him for it. He was punished for, you know, for taking up the resources of the system and making people do their jobs. And, you know, and there was no way he got a fair trial. In fact, most of the exonerating evidence was withheld from him during the trial, which is obviously illegal. So he got that unfair trial, but he was sentenced to life in prison. But and later on, sentenced to be executed. And so he's been on death row now for over 30 years. He is a fan of music. He has records, CDs. They don't let him have records. I mean, I don't know, maybe the edges are too sharp or something. I mean, the prison system is just like it's unbelievably cruel. So we only have that one season, but it's a good one. It's a good one, and I recommend anybody who is interested, you know, in learning more about Keith to tune into some of our animated discussions. We had a good time.
I was listening to your story about a cardboard keyboard, and I was thinking, oh, you know, you could have one of those that sort of rolled up in your cell. tell us the story of the cardboard keyboard.
So I wanted to play. I was bothering my mom for years to play music. My first wish was drums. And we lived in a small apartment, and, you know, that was instantly vetoed.
This is in Brooklyn?
This was in Brooklyn, New York. I started badgering my mom from the time I was 5 years old to take lessons. And by the time I was seven, she finally gave in and let me take lessons with the woman who had taught her. And she was not a jazz teacher. She had gone to school for classical music at Spelman College in the South. But she agreed to take me on, and she told me that, you know, she would helped me go as far as I could. She gave me my first lesson to play five notes of the C major scale. And she said, well, go home and practice. And we'll come back next week and we'll see how you did. And I was very excited. I was, okay, I'm going to practice. And I walked out the door and I stopped at the steps and I turned around and I said, but I don't have a piano. And she said, oh, I got something for you. So she goes back and she gets this little folded up piece of cardboard, and she unfolds it and she says, you see these notes? These are the notes that you have to play. You put your finger on each one of these as if it was a piano, a key on the piano, and you can practice that way. And I was so excited. And I practiced every day, you know, and when I came back, I was able to complete the lesson. It was actually heaven to actually hear a sound connected with the pressing of that key. You know, I think that was a fascinating thing to me. This went on for a few months until one day I came home and I saw this huge piece of furniture in the living room. And it turned out that it was a little spinet piano.
From Brooklyn, you went to Pennsylvania to college, which is where you met Gil Scott-Heron.
That's right. That's where I met Gil.
Gil had already, he was a published poet at the time.
He was already a published poet. He had written a book of poetry called Small Talk at 125th and Lenox. It was a great work. You know, it was actually inspired, in my view, from some of the work of Langston Hughes and of County Cullen, Gwendolyn Brooks, and so many other great poets of the age, Sonia Sanchez. Yeah, so yeah, he had already had this book. There was a talent show. One of the seniors was a singer, and he had intended to enter the talent show and happened to hear me playing one day in one of the practice rooms. And he came up to me and he said, hey man, you sound pretty good. I wonder, you know, can you play God Bless the Child? And I said, well, yeah, I know it. And I said, well, you're just doing one song? He said, no, I'm doing two. And there's another song that's written by this guy, and I know, a friend of mine. He said, oh, he's right next door. You want to meet him? And so he comes in, this guy with this big fro, and he's like kind of mumbling under his breath. You know, like, hey, how you doing, man? I'm good. And he sits down and he plays his song that's called Peace. And you can hear that song when you hear it. Just imagine me hearing that for the first time in that little practice room, and you'll see what I experienced, you'll understand what I experienced. Tell me where can a man find peace? Tell me which way.
The idea came that the two of you should work together.
Instantly it happened.
And why? What made it so instant?
Well, I think that he really dug my playing. And when I listened to the lyrics that he wrote for this song, I thought, my God, this could have been written by a 40-year-old man. And I'm looking at a 19-year-old here. And I thought, I got all these songs. I mean, I consider myself a bit of a lyricist, but I took forever to write lyrics. I thought anybody could do it maybe a year faster, I'd kind of be into it. So I said, man, I got this song here, you know, I hope we could, you know, what do you think? Maybe we could get together and write some lyrics on it. So he asked me, I played the song for him, and he said, well, what were you thinking? And I said, well, it's kind of a song to the ancestors, you know, I kind of raised my glass to them, you know, all the people who came before us, who struggled and fought for us, you know, for our freedom and our rights. And he says, okay, I'll play it again. So I played again. He starts, takes out his pen. He wrote all his lyrics in pen, you know, like, not too cocky. Huh? You know, there will be no erasure. So he writes, you know, and he says, oh, let's play it again. So I play it a couple more times. And then he has this song. He goes over in the corner with Victor and he's kind of singing the words to him and everything. Long story short, our first song, 15 minutes later, after having met 20 minutes before, a toast to the people. We didn't put it out right away, but yeah, that was our first song.
And so you knew that this was a duo that would work instantly then?
From that point on, we figured we could keep doing that. If we could keep doing that, that would be a good thing. We wanted to be songwriters. We didn't really want to be artists. We thought, hey, man, we could keep writing songs like we wrote, you know, for Victor or, you know, or the band, the Black and Blues that we had back then in college. We'd be great, you know, just songwriters. But after we wrote a few songs and we kind of surveyed our content, you know, we realized that, okay, maybe the Spinners are not going to do this, are not going to do The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, you know, or Pieces of a Man, you know what I mean? So in the end, we realized that if we wanted anybody to hear our songs, we would probably have to do them ourselves.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out.
The Coltranes aren't somebody you mentioned there in the story. Did you ever actually run into either of them?
I became aware of them when I was about 14. The first album that Gil and I actually sat down to listen to together was Cosmic Music by John and Alice. I think it kind of set the glue for our relationship, you know, the fact that we could both like listen to this and be inspired by it, you know, I think it said something about us both. I actually did see Alice play once. It was in New York, and she spent most of her time on the harmonium. You know, that little instrument that sounds kind of like an ebony organ. When she plays it, it doesn't sound like anything else you will have ever heard. And she just sat there cross-legged, you know, pretty much the whole time. It was a small club, you know, it was just a small club somewhere. And I thought to myself, why? You know, why is she playing in a small club?
And what kind of people were there? Were there Hare Krishnas or
devotees? You know? Devotees of all kinds, you know, mostly of Alice. But yeah, there was some Hare Krishnas there. You know, there were. I think I probably could have easily been converted by after that show.
You were saying that there's a relationship between the fingering of a sax and a flute, so I guess we should be able to hear Coltrane in your flute playing, maybe.
Oh, well, no. Somewhere deep, you know, maybe in my mind. But, you know, a harp is a piano turned on the side, you know, or either that or a piano is a harp turned on the side, you know, whatever. But the strings, there is still strings, and I always thought that the harp was a really interesting instrument to, you know, to go into jazz with. It's very powerful. I mean, you know, the first time I heard it, I was kind of alarmed, you know, because I don't think I was prepared for the emotional waves that, you know, that she was able to create with her with the harp. And, you know, I could relate to that too, and some part of me was able to kind of hear her thinking, and Coltrane even. John himself, you know, when they talked about the sheets of sound that he played, I heard somewhere that he used to study harp music to get these kind of movements, you know, because it creates a whole image, a picture, like a moving picture, and she was brilliant at that.
A little bit about this project celebrating Alice Coltrane. What's happening there, and how did you get involved?
Alina Bethinsky is an artist, and she sent me some stuff that she had been working on. Plus, I started listening to some of her, you know, just out of curiosity, started listening to some of her work, and I thought to myself, there is an element here that I recognize. She was able to really to authentically bring the feel of what Alice was doing to her music. From that point on, I think one time I said to her, have you ever thought about doing any, dedicating Alice Coltrane music? And she said, well, actually I had. And, next year, this was like last year, she was saying, next year is like the celebration of Alice's kind of first pivotal, her biggest release. And, we thought maybe this is the time for us to try and do something.
Brian Jackson there, and celebrating Alice Coltrane with Brian along with Alina Bazinska and the Hip Harp Collective is at the Triskell Arts Centre as part of this year's Cork Jazz Festival on October 24th and 25th. Some tickets remain for the 24th. GuinnessJazz.ie for those. A belated premiere next. Down-born Hamilton Harty figured prominently in the musical ferment of late 19th century Dublin when institutions such as the Fesh Ciall were reviving classical music in the capital. He went on to fame in Britain as a composer and conductor. All the same, it's taken until this coming Saturday for the Republic of Ireland premiere of Harty's Piano Quintet in F major. On Saturday, the Fuse Ensemble will give the work some of that attention it's been lacking, as musicologist and Harty specialist Jeremy Dibble told Culturefile.
I got involved with Hamilton Harty 10 or more years ago when I was actually doing some research on late 19th, early 20th century Irish composers, people like Michele Esposito, who was Harty's mentor. Esposito was a curious character. I mean, he came from the Naples Conservatoire. I think he was looking for a sort of more permanent salaried job. And one came up in Dublin, came over for really what, maybe a year or two, and ended up staying for about 46. He was very interested in helping the Fesh Ciall to be set up. Stamford had originally been asked to be the first president, and so, of course, he actually pulled out in the end. But Esposito, I think, was instrumental, literally, in setting up various prizes for things like Irish symphonies. And, of course, he won the first Irish symphony prize himself. And then, of course, after Esposito's prize, Harty then himself won a prize for the Irish Symphony in 1904, which was his first major orchestral work. Harty was noticed very much by singers like John McCormack, who I think came to visibility through the Fesh Ciall in very, very late, early 1900s. And actually, Harty took over as an accompanist for McCormack, and that remained a very close relationship for very many years afterwards. And of course, Harty, I think, began to make his name really as an accompanist. He actually never went to conservatory. He never went to university to study music. He was almost entirely self-taught. I think, like many people of his generation, perhaps growing up in the 1890s with the whole Irish literary revival, the Celtic twilight, he was interested in arranging Irish tunes, but also Irish texts as well. So some of them aren't necessarily arrangements of Irish tunes as much as they are kind of synthetic or synthetic style of Irish music. And I think this infects a great deal of his music even after the Irish Symphony of 1904.
You use a very interesting phrase there, synthetic Irish. Is there something you could say about what made it sound Irish? Like what is that quality that you're talking about there?
I think in particular, Hart is rather interesting. I mean, he was undoubtedly influenced by the tradition that was really established by Charles Villiers Stanford and Charles Wood in the 1880s and 90s of arranging, making very beautiful artistic arrangements of Irish tunes, publishing them in volumes and so on, with the help of people like Alfred Percival Graves, who was a great Irish folklorist and linguist. But one thing that I think Harty seems to pick up on is also the, what you might call the Seán Nós tradition of Irish music, with this very elaborate form of embellishment. The piano quintet was recorded a few years ago. I mean, Harty won this Lewis Hill Prize, and, you know, and it paid 50 guineas as the first prize. I mean, Harty must have been able to live off that for several years, I should think. He would have been about 25, 26. I mean, he was born in 1879. So clearly, again, the piano part, which is actually really very, again, very demanding, was written for him. I mean, it was clearly designed for him, just like other piano quintets, people like Schumann and Brahms were designed ultimately for them to play with their own capable pianistic abilities. It got very few performances. Just one performance at the Concertgoers Society at Langham Hotel in, what, 1906. And then it seems to have disappeared from view, and it remained in manuscript. It's still unpublished. It's not available in published form. And yet it's a substantial work, and I think is quite happy to stand alongside, in musical terms, you know, those classic piano quintets of people like Fauré, Schumann, Brahms. You know, there it is, 1906, and it's still barely known.
Jeremy Dibble on the life of Hamilton Harty, and that premiere of Hamilton's Piano Quintet in F Major is at Galway University this evening and at Carlingford Heritage Centre on Sunday afternoon. newrychambermusic.org for info and tickets. Anyone familiar with the noise tortures used in the north of Ireland in the 1970s, the idea of voluntarily subjecting yourself to white noise seems fairly unhinged. But in recent times, white noise has become a streaming phenomenon, with endless loops of hissy drones replacing muzak and lullabies to induce calm and good sleep. But according to music writer and software developer Chris Weingarten, most of the available material isn't created as art and ignores the music artists working in the area. So Weingarten teamed up with such artists as composer Owen Pallett, experimental pianist Kelly Moran, and nature recordist Chris Watson to create the app Fuzzle and corner the market for high-quality, artisanal white noise, as he explained to Culturefile from his workshop in LA. To get people started about white noise. Now, there's two sort of distinct things here. There's white noise, which is a sort of relative of lo-fi beats for studying and concentration, and there's white noise as a kind of engineer's phenomenon. Tell us what the difference between those and what those are.
White noise, in its pure scientific sense, is, you know, a concept of, you know, spectrum filling sound of, you know, a certain degree. And this app is not that. This app is the more colloquial use of white noise, of, you know, background sounds and, you know, long drones that people use to concentrate or to, you know, relax or work. However, you know, the many reasons that people use sound as sort of a utilitarian part of their day. that's where I got familiar with the concept of white noise, you know, using an app to absolutely drown out all elements of the spectrum. You know, my experience with white noise apps is pretty much just to drown out someone who's snoring in the next room in a hotel. To take something, to take a sound that is arrhythmic and distracting and turn it into something constant and relaxing.
As well as kind of covering up the sort of deodorant effect, there is, it's supposed to be some other thing going on with your brain and broad spectrum sound.
I am not promoting this as a wellness app. You know, this is supposed to be something that is very value neutral, and I want people to bring to it what they bring to it.
The story of Fuzzle, which is great, because there really aren't enough words with three Z's together in them. What's the sort of commercial history of white noise?
People are creating these white noise channels on YouTube and on Spotify and white noise podcasts, and they, you know, a lot of them are algorithmically generated, you know, sound for 12 hours, and they're eating up a lot of space. And Spotify was saying that these are taking up way too much space on our hard drives or our servers or whatever. We need to lose some of these things. The white noise was costing Spotify just an obscene amount of money. Beyond their success on YouTube, beyond ambient playlists getting a little more popular, it's just, you know, it seemed like there was a real demand for utilitarian sound, for sound made for a purpose. From what I gather, I think a lot of those sounds are very anonymous and they're very, you know, clinical. And I wanted to do something that has a little more intent behind it. Something that blurs the line between like discovering an artist on an ambient playlist and, you know, searching YouTube for 12 hours of, you know, hypnotic space noise. Like there should be something that bridges those gaps, because, you know, when you get right down to it, the sounds are not that dissimilar between the stuff that us nerds, you know, call music and the stuff that a lot of non-nerds call lo-fi sounds to study to.
You call it artisanal white noise. That almost makes me feel restlessly uncomfortable. I think there's irony going on here. I can't sleep if there's irony going on.
You know, I would be lying if I said it wasn't a little tongue-in-cheek. Of course, it's supposed to be unserious, but it's also, I think, a succinct way of describing what it is. You know, it is white noise with intent, with purpose, with the mind of a gifted musician, with the gear of a acclaimed artist who makes music that you may or may not have heard of. Like, it is something different, something elevated, something more.
Chris Swinegarden there, and Fuzzle with, like he said, three Z's is available on the iPhone App Store with a version for Android in the works. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. Don't forget, you can find the program in all the places you find your podcasts. And we'll be back with more broad spectrum irony on the radio next Saturday tea time on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.